Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. Chris Zook is with me today. He is a partner at Bain & Company. He's been the co-head of the firm's global strategy practice for 20 years. The other co-head, as it happens, is James Allen. Together, they have written the book, The Founder's Mentality: How to Overcome the Predictable Crises of Growth. It's an excellent book. It's well articulated. It's smart. It comes out of the strategy practice at Bain. And there's a lot for us to learn today, and I already know from some brief conversation that I've had with Chris is that he is the one to talk to us about it. So, Chris, welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Thanks very much for having me on. It's a great privilege.
Chris, describe for us the elements of a founder's mentality. What are the three pieces?
Sure. About 5 years ago, we began an effort to look at the secrets of enduring success around the world today. We spent 5 years on this. We went to 40 countries. We built a huge database. And one fact really, really jumped out at us, which led to those three elements of the founder's mentality. And that fact was we found that companies where the founder was still the CEO or deeply involved in the company in some way, like let's say Nike would be an example, performed in the last 15 years 3.1 times better, an amazing margin over all other companies. And even when we took out the obvious huge success stories like Google and Facebook and Silicon Valley, it was still 2.6. And so we said, what is that? Founders differ enormously. What is the common theme about what the great founders infused into their companies to make them perform sustainably for a long time and stay energetic relative to young people? And what we found were three things out of dozens possibly that you could find. One, those companies had what we called an insurgent mission. There was something spiky about them that made them special that everyone in the company really understood. You know, think of Elon Musk, the mission to populate Mars with SpaceX, or think of Google organizing all the world's information. But even think of a local restaurant that really has something very special about what it wants to do. That energizes people. Second, we found something that we called frontline obsession. You know, the founder initially is the frontline, is often the first salesperson, turns on the lights in the morning. You know, they may have been the first product developer, and they love the detail. They have an intellectual curiosity for it. But as companies grow, they very often lose that. And sometimes you even have decisions moving into the center of the company to people who have never visited a customer, may never have served a customer, never been in a factory, never worked at the front line. You lose your frontline instincts when that happens. And the third element of the founder's mentality was what we called an owner's mindset. And this links to the very deep feeling of personal responsibility to act on things quickly, solve problems, very anti-bureaucratic view that is the heart and soul of a lot of the great founders. And when they're gone, sometimes you see companies turn into, you know, just another company, just another bank. And what our work is a look at the journey of companies through their life cycles, beginning with the founder's mentality, and then looking at how some companies stay young and others age prematurely.
One of the things that I like about this is that you're not just leaving it to the variable of the founder itself, but the mentality piece, right? Which is that you're saying that there's a mentality that founders have that need to permeate the organization. And that feels really critical because you have companies where the founder is no longer there, but the success continues because there is a founder's mentality that permeates the organization.
Yeah, young companies very often have a great idea. You know, think of Netflix or think of Tesla. And some funding, some backers, a smart team, but they're going up against the world. They're going up against enormous companies, often with distribution networks, assets, money, cash, brands, everything. And how is it? How is it that so many young founder companies manage to gain against gigantic companies that seem to have everything? And I think one of the key things, the huge differentiation of young founder companies are these human elements inside. You know, we did some work across hundreds of companies around the world, and we found that right now, we had never seen this before, 85% of executives, senior executives and CEOs say their biggest barriers to achieving sustained success are internal. And in big companies, it was 94%. And these elements of the founder's mentality are a little bit the inside game of strategy. You know, these are the deep inner root causes of success and failure that often pre-exist and are there before success or failure happens on the outside. You know, it's like Usain Bolt last night when he was asked, what is key to winning with such tight margins? He said, you know, at this time for me, it's about maintaining mental toughness through the race, through my training. And this is a little bit the inner game of strategy. How do companies maintain that mental toughness they have? They have to have, frankly, as a young founder company. But as they get older and more bureaucratic and people are more distant from the front line, you know, how do you maintain that life energy, the soul?
You talk about that when you talk about the paradox of growth, that growth leads to complexity and then complexity kills growth. And you talk about these three crises of internal complexity that often follow growth. Can you describe those briefly? And then I want to go into the challenge of developing a founder's mentality in the context of these three crises.
Sure. You know, and some of your listeners may recall a book called Passages, which was about the life cycle and predictable stages of humans. And that there were predictable crises in your 30s and predictable crises in your 50s and predictable crises of older age. And we found that there were three sets of inflection points or moments in the life of a company that determined, in terms of the decisions made and the actions taken, about 80 to 90% of all the big value swings during their life. And each of them, interestingly, we found a very tight and unique link to the elements of the founder's mentality. So the first is what we called overload. This is, you know, what Tesla is trying to do, increasing by 10 times to get to the scale where they can compete sustainably against big car companies. And it's very tough to take a young company and scale it 10 times while maintaining its life energy. We call this the crisis of overload. The second is the more common one, which is a company that has been growing for a while and suddenly begins to slow down as it becomes larger. You know, you saw this to an extreme degree a number of years ago at Starbucks when growth went negative. Market value went down 85%, and the founder, Howard Schultz, had to come back. And what he found were internal problems, not that the market had dried up or Starbucks was saturated. He said these are self-inflicted wounds, and they related to things that that he could change. They lost the core sense of the company. And we call that stall out. It happens to two-thirds of companies over just a little more than a decade, and only about 1 in 7 or 1 in 8. Ever recover. And the third crisis is a little less frequent, maybe at any moment in time, about 6 or 7% of companies are in that. And this is what we call free fall. This is when the fundamental elements of the business model propelling a company begin to become obsolete. You know, so think of a taxi company against Uber, or think years ago of Blockbuster against, all of the downloading of information over the internet. You know, those are cases of free fall. Or Marvel Comics years ago, you know, when people were switching from reading comic books and stashing them under their bed, as I did when I was very young, and then the rejuvenation of Marvel. you know, was a complete change in its business model. So those are the three crises. And we found the founder's mentality either to maintain it or in some cases, if you've lost it, to renew it, to be at the essence of fixing companies on the outside, inside, so they can perform better on the outside.
So these are external factors, right? Overload, stall out, and free fall are external factors that confront an organization. And what you're saying is the biggest challenge isn't those factors themselves, but it's the way the organization confronts them. And it's the internal complexity, the internal challenges. I had also noted that figure that you described, 90% of barriers cited by large company executives had their roots in internal dysfunction. And what I'm wondering about is specifically the turnaround element of this. So all of us can look at an external factor and say, okay, we need to handle this. And if we already have an owner's mentality or we're already obsessed with the front line or we already have this insurgent mission, then it's not hard in some ways to apply what's already happening. It's natural to apply what we're already doing to this external challenge. But what about when there's not a founder? Howard Schultz has left and he doesn't come back. Or Steve Jobs has left and he doesn't come back. How do we, from a strategy execution perspective, how do we embed an organization with an owner's mindset when the founder may not be there at all?
You know, this is probably the greatest challenge and the way that many founders can add the greatest long-term value to their companies is by trying to do that. You know, there's a lot of interesting examples like Bob Iger at Rejuvenating Disney and basically going back and unearthing many of the principles that made Walt Disney great in the first place. Going back and buying Pixar and buying Marvel and purchasing the rights to some of the original characters that they had sold, and placing the animation, a new repeatable formula, front and center. And it's why people have been terrified about how they're going to replace him. And he keeps extending his CEO term. Or the rejuvenation of Lego. You know, Lego was 18 months from bankruptcy and was one of the great founder stories in Europe over several generations, frankly, through the sun, until the family began to depart from the principles that made Lego great. And the new CEO, Jorgen Vik Knudstorp, came in and he realized that there are 71 Lego blocks on planet Earth for every man, woman, and child. It was amazing.
I was very impressed by that statistic when I heard that statistic.
You know, and the question was, well, who are that? Who are the people that are so addicted to Lego? And Lego had gone into businesses beyond its core that sapped energy. He eliminated the complexity and got them out of all of them. They had a big corporate headquarters. He moved the headquarters back closer to the front line into the distribution center. They had lost a sense of the principles of the founder that were called the great principles of play. In fact, Lego means leg got, comes from that Danish word, which means play well. And he found out where all these Lego blocks were, that there are about 300 to 400,000 very deeply obsessed Lego customers, from architects who were older to children with, you know, certain obsessions, certain creative obsessions. And they began bringing those people into the process of designing Lego. And then they brought technology into the bricks. And then in reducing complexity further, they realized that about 70% of the parts in any Lego set were not reused. And this is hugely costly in terms of making molds in the factory. And so they went to the opposite, where 70 to 80% now are reused across many sets. And, you know, in reducing complexity, going back to the original founder's mission that made it special, that made Lego the number one toy of the century, is voted by the British Toy Association. They rejuvenated it. And now it's the most valuable toy company in the world. And it's one of the great turnarounds in the last decade in Europe. And in talking to Jorgen Vik and having been a little bit involved in that one as it was happening, you know, I think a lot of the rejuvenation of Lego was about a return to the elements of the founders' mentality of the new of the insurgent mission dialed up, of which people are now very excited about. A return to make heroes at the front line and get into contact with the customers, which they did, moving power from the bureaucracy out. And third, having a much more fast reaction time, owner's mindset. And, you know, you just see that pattern in many of the renewals.
I could safely say that my family has more than its share of 71 Lego pieces per person. So I'm certainly supporting that that statistic. What you're talking about, and you've written quite a bit about this also, is sticking with the core of your core, understanding what it is that made you great and sticking with that in many ways. What made you successful is a key piece, but how do you know when diversification is important? How do you allow for change?
You know, diversification is an interesting word. Most of the companies that were sustainable did go into other businesses in one of two ways. They either found a very deep strength that they had that would allow them to spawn a new business. So, you know, Amazon Web Services was derived from the amazing strength that Amazon had in its server farms and its technology in its core business. And then it began selling some of the capacity and those IT capabilities. And now it's two-thirds of the profits of Amazon. Now, in a way, it's diversification. Say, oh my God, computer services all the way from retailing online. But when you really drill down in, you know, what I think what you find is that it's a pretty close adjacency, and that it reinforced the core to go into that, and it also extended the core as opposed to leaping to a complete new lily pad. You know, it was the discovery of a hidden asset. And, you know, we found that basically to be the pattern of growth. So it's a funny form of focus and expansion. Yongwei is a company in China. It's a competitor to Walmart, and their insurgent mission is creating the best, freshest food for the Chinese mother, which is an issue in many areas of China. But they have red and green stores now, and the red stores are their historic format, but the green stores are run by a different group in the company and are pushed to innovate and come up with new ideas, new formats, sometimes radically different than what were being done in the red stores. And, you know, I think imagine if Nokia had listened to the groups of engineers that were coming to senior management saying, let us go off with these mock-ups of a smartphone and do this. Nokia was giving away more in dividends than any tech company in the 90s, buying back its shares, a sign they don't know what to do with their money, and had dominated the small camera business in their phones. The first email were theirs. They had touchscreen technologies, and they didn't invest in inventing the future. So I think the two ways you grow from your core are either spawning a new business that pushes the future out, or finding an adjacent business that strengthens and reinforces your core at the same time. Where companies get in trouble is like what happened with Lego. You know, Lego jumped into a whole range of things thinking that the brand was a vehicle to go into new businesses. You know, they said we're the best brand to families, and so we're going to have a joint venture with Steven Spielberg in miniature theaters. We're going to buy theme parks to propagate the brand. We're going to go into plastic watches for girls and clothing and all of that. And none of that reinforced the core. It distracted it, and it almost brought the company down. So I think those are the two formulas that companies take and find growth from their core. We found that was true in about 90% of companies that constantly were able to sort of reinvent themselves on the fly.
Yet didn't some of that stuff work very well for Disney? I'm thinking theme parks, I'm thinking, you know, action figures and things that Lego has tried and has failed for Lego, but has been quite successful and very much part of the strategy for Disney.
Well, I think Disney began to dilute itself when it began to get into a lot of the television programs and things that moved away from the characters in the cinematic cartoon core of the early years. You know, I think Lego doesn't really have characters that are associated with it. It's a brand and it's a toy system, where the essence, I think, of Disney was the range of characters from Mickey and Minnie Mouse to Donald Duck, and we can go on and on and on, that were lent themselves much more naturally to adjacencies where people would feel kind of that emotional connection to the characters. And, you know, I think it also allowed them, therefore, to go into others. You know, if you look at the revenue stream from The Lion King, you know, a Disney great character example, the overwhelming majority of the revenue stream for a long period of time were from the stuffed lions and the videos and other things that stemmed from those characters. So in my opinion, at least, you know, I really believe that Disney was more about the characters, where Lego was ultimately more about the play experience.
That makes a lot of sense. It's a good distinction. I'm speaking with Chris Zook. The Founder's Mentality is his book, How to Overcome the Predictable Crises of Growth. Let's talk, Chris, for a moment about execution. So if I want to spread the Founder's Mentality through the organization, it requires more than just a communication plan and training. How do you move an organization to shift from a loss of accountability in many ways, a lack of insurgent mission, a sense of bureaucracy rather than an obsession with the front line? How do you make those shifts in an organization so that the change reaps its benefit?
Well, one of the things we did in looking at case studies was to go out and talk to executives who had been involved in doing exactly that. Some were founders who returned to their companies and are in the process of renewing it. Michael Dell would be an example. And, you know, some are cases of executives who came into disastrous situations and basically refounded the company, like Kent Thierry did at DaVita. Bankrupt, near bankrupt kidney dialysis company 15 years ago, and now five times bigger healthcare company, the best performing stock, up 100 times since then. And you're right. You know, it isn't a top-down set of ideas and communications and corporate plans that are done in corporate planning offices and presented in PowerPoint. These renewals actually have to come from the bottom up. And we found many, many, many practices where a company, sort of a menu that they could select from. Let me just give you four or five, because there are so many. But they ultimately have to reach down to the front line. You know, one example of a renewal is what Sir George Buckley, did when he was CEO of 3M. And 3M was losing its vital vitality in its core adhesives business and abrasives business. And it stems from a whole range of things that had been done over time to save money. And one of those was actually dismembering some of the things that the founders put in that made the company great in the first place. And he reinstituted some of those. For example, he found that they used to give engineers a day a week off in order to work on ideas. If they had a great idea, they could take a day a week to do that. And that's where a lot of the great products of 3M had come from. And their new product vitality index had gone down by about 70%. And when he began to do that and open up some of the R&D facilities again, the company was renewed. And when he left, he had over 1,000 people waiting to shake his hands, mostly bench engineers, because he had reached that down into the company and liberated energy to where they were, where the company had begun to diversify into pharmaceuticals and things like that. You know, another thing you can do is to create mini founder experiences through the company. You know, the person who has the founder's mentality doesn't just have to be the senior team. It can be people who are in charge of initiatives or departments. Even my own company, Bain & Company, we were last year, and I'm quite proud of this, voted by Glass Ceiling the best company to work for in America by young people, most desired place. And I actually think, you know, a lot of that has to do with ways that we reach down into the front line and do, we used to do monthly, and now we do two weekly, and soon we're going to do one weekly quick 7-question surveys of every team in the company, which is anonymously done and gives the younger people, the analysts, a voice. Are we working on the right things? Am I getting feedback, et cetera? And these fast cycle time connectivity to the front line, I think, are at the essence of keeping the founder's mentality and having everyone, every team, feel that they have a mini founder experience. You know, another thing you can do is one thing Les Wexner has always done at L Brands, and this is the best performing CEO founder for 35 years in the world, according to Harvard Business Press's survey of global shareholder returns of founder companies. And he told me that every Monday, they have a Monday morning meeting of the senior team, and they say, what are the big growth initiatives and performance initiatives? They go through them, and if there's anything blocking progress, they then have a Tuesday morning follow-up every day, every week, 52 weeks a year, where the person who is involved in being in the way says what they are going to do to solve that. And it hugely increases the metabolism, whereas most companies make decisions by committees, and they languish, and they have to get together again, and, you know, that's the second practice. You know, another thing you can do is we're finding micro battles are very, very important. You know, very often companies say we want to gain market share in beer in California as a target. But what's really powerful is if you then bring that down and you say, you know what, the epicenter, the best acid test of our ability to do that is what we do in these 5, you know, Latino communities with this particular beer over this particular time in this particular outlet. And the whole management team gets behind a particular micro battle. And, you know, that's very powerful also in getting people back to the ground level. Final one, and I could go on, I promise I won't, but is, you know, you're very, I was in experience with a management team that made their mark, turned around a company by really rejuvenating the front line. And I asked them as they were starting to slow down, I'll go around the table and say how much more time they or less they now spend at the customers. And they looked at each other and they said, oh my God, it's really dissipated. We are now spending most of our time in structured corporate meetings. They decided to go back, x-ray their calendars, and begin to force themselves to go back into the outlets and into the stores for a certain amount of time every month. And many of the great founder-led companies, you know, force their management to be in the factories, be in the stores, be in the customers, get off behind the desk. So those kinds of role modeling behaviors are just a few of, I think, the very practical things. Symbolism is very important here. And, you know, what the leadership team talks about and how they spend their time is of the essence. And I'll just close with one observation. The grandson, now CEO of Oberoi Hotels, viewed a few years ago as the greatest luxury hotel chain in the world, told me that, you know, even at the age of 93, he would visit his great grandfather, M.S. Oberoi, the founder in India from very poor rural area. Amazing that he, what he did at home. And he said, he would say at 10 or 11 in the morning, he'd be sitting there with customer comment cards, even though he could only see 3 inches in front of his eyes, reading them and still scrawling his comments. And, you know, that kind of detailed frontline obsession and passion is where companies have to start if they want to renew themselves.
What I love about what you're saying is it reinforces this underlying issue that you face in your book, which is this growth paradox, which is that growth leads to complexity, complexity kills growth. And ultimately, everything that you're describing is the one thing that an organization can do that a leader models to drive the owner's mentality, the the sort of the founder's mentality, the sort of fundamental path back to greatness is usually in simplifying, not becoming more complex. And that the challenge from a strategic perspective is to find what is that one thing that's going to make the biggest difference. If you could identify the one thing that we probably go back to, it's probably related to the core of what made us great originally, and to focus on it and do something dramatic that is clear, that symbolizes the importance of getting back to the basics of what it is that we do that's valued by the marketplace. And I think, you know, in all of the work that we do around strategy execution, the first step is always to discover what is the one thing that's going to make the biggest difference in what's most important to this organization over the next 12 months, and really focus any work that is driven towards strategy execution on that one thing. And that one thing usually ends up bringing a whole lot of other things along with it. But the clarity you get from that is really powerful. Chris, the book is The Founder's Mentality, How to Overcome the Predictable Crises of Growth. Chris Zook is the author, along with James Allen. Chris, it's been such a delight having this conversation with you. I really love how you put the limelight on a couple of elements to the book. The book itself is really fantastic and well worth a read. Thank you for being on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Well, thanks. I've enjoyed it immensely.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.